Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
When it comes to democratic participation, most people would agree that civil discourse, a tolerance for the opinions of others, and the willingness to compromise are essential attributes for the citizenry. For Christians, such attributes are championed throughout the Old Testament and the New Testament. Proverbs 18, verse 13 states, "To answer before listening, that is folly and shame." Likewise, Proverbs 15, verse 1 makes the observation, "A gentle answer turns away wrath, but harsh words stir up anger." In 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 15 and 16, it is said, "But in your hearts revere Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for your hope that you have. But do this with gentleness and respect, keeping a clear conscience, so that those who speak maliciously against your good behavior in Christ may be ashamed of their slander." Alas, in today's world, citizens often fall short of these lofty virtues, and Christians are no exception. Political rhetoric is often vitriolic. When the stakes of the game are high, and when certain groups are passionate about certain candidates and issues, good behavior is often difficult to achieve. In recent decades, the Christian right has come under increasing criticism for violating democratic civic norms. Some leaders of this movement, such as Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell, have been accused of making intemperate remarks and staking out uncompromising and often theocratic positions on public policy. And there is perhaps no other area where the norms of civil discourse seem to break down more than the issue of abortion, where groups affiliated with the Christian right, such as Randall Terry's Operation Rescue, have engaged in confrontational and often violent tactics to achieve their policy objectives. Indeed, during the 1980s, it was quite common to see news stories about abortion clinics being blockaded, broken into, and even bombed. Abortion doctors were often threatened, attacked, and even murdered. And it was recently, in 2009, that George Tiller, a doctor known for performing late-term abortions, was gunned down while he attended his church in Wichita, Kansas. Such events certainly make the headlines and help to frame members of the Christian right as intolerant and potentially anti-democratic. But is this image generally true? Is it possible that Christian conservatives actually enhance the process of democratic deliberation and citizen participation? To address these questions, I am joined today by Professor John Shields. Professor Shields is an assistant professor of government at Claremont McKenna College and author of the most recent book, The Democratic Virtues of the Christian Right, published in 2009 by Princeton University Press. In addition to this work, he has also authored a variety of pieces for publications such as The Wilson Quarterly, Critical Review, and The New Republic. John, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thanks for having me.
Your recent book sets out to judge Christian conservatives against a set of normative criteria about deliberation and civil discourse. The title of your book actually calls these democratic virtues. Before evaluating whether the religious right lives up to those virtues, it's probably a good idea to know definitionally what we're talking about here. I mean, it might seem self-evident what democratic virtues are, but it is worth talking about. What do you consider to be democratic virtues, and why are they so important?
That's a good question. Well, in any democracy in which citizens have reasonable disagreements over what the good society looks like, ideally they'd advance their own position in a way that is both civil and reasonable. And without these sorts of without these virtues, I think most of our disagreements would quickly degrade into shouting matches. And when this happens, it's especially hard for those citizens who are caught in the middle of these controversies to make informed, intelligent decisions about what the good society should look like. And in the case of religious citizens, I think it's especially important that they make their case by appealing to reason rather than sectarian metaphysics. And I make this case because I think it's important for citizens to defend their positions on grounds that are universally acceptable to all citizens. So, for example, it's one thing for pro-lifers to argue that we should defend embryos because human organisms are intrinsically valuable and that there's not morally significant differences between embryos and newborns. It's quite another thing to say that we should defend embryos by appealing to God's will or to Scripture, because these sorts of foundations are not acceptable to those who don't share this sort of common religious ground.
Yeah, so, living in a religiously plural society, that message won't necessarily resonate with everybody.
That's right. That's right. So there needs to be some universal ground in which we can all sort of have a conversation with one another. And traditionally that has been found through appeals to reason. So by democratic virtues, I partly mean things like the practice of civility and respect, listening to the other side, and making appeals to reason rather than Scripture. And collectively I call these things deliberative norms, because they really help elevate the marketplace of ideas, and they help all of us to make better judgments about what justice requires.
I should note that we're conducting this interview on Tuesday, November 2nd, actually late in the afternoon. This is during a hotly contested midterm election, and the results are just starting to come in right now. But we're not going to be airing this podcast until December. But the midterm that we're in the midst of, or the midterm election that we're in the midst of right now, is certainly very heated. And we've seen over the past year or so the emergence of the Tea Party movement. We've seen several massive marches on the U.S. Capitol building to protest health care and tax policies. Television radio pundit Glenn Beck, for instance, held a rally in Washington, D.C. that was called Restore American Honor, which had a highly religious overtone. And that event provoked a counter rally by comedians Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert to restore sanity and or fear, as they called it. And in the midst of this very heated campaign, it just seems that the temperature of the rhetoric has really risen quite a bit. And looking at this, more people seem to be involved in the political process. Can't it be said that a good old-fashioned shouting match between partisans is part of the American culture and actually maybe good for democracy?
Yeah, I think it's a great point, Tony. And when I use the term democratic virtues, I'm not just talking about these kinds of deliberative norms that I just mentioned. I'm also talking about participation. So ideally, a good democratic society is not simply one in which partisans make serious and reasonable arguments. It's not some dry academic, right, cerebral exchange. Mm-hmm. A good democracy is also one that engages a large number of citizens in the decisions that shape their lives. And so a healthy democracy is one in which citizens actually, you know, care about the public interest and don't isolate themselves from others in a sort of small circle of family and friends. And the problem is that these democratic goods that I've just described are often in tension. So, for example, most of us probably think that a participatory democracy is a good thing.
Right.
And most of us think that deliberation is good as well. But as I try to show in my book, these goods are often in tension. And there's a number of ways that these sorts of goods collide. If you're a movement leader, for example, you obviously have to stir public passions to attract new members and retain old ones. And so you need to make dramatic and strident appeals to get citizens to freely give of their time and money. So, for example, you mentioned Tea Party marches. Marches are a great way to fire up a movement. They create solidarity. They remind citizens that they're truly part of a national movement. And without this sort of agitation, without this sort of collective action and passion, you can't really build a social movement at all. Mm-hmm. Right? We wouldn't really have social movements in any meaningful way. But this is, I guess what I want to emphasize in my book is that movement leaders don't simply do this. They don't simply organize marches and fire up activists and get them to say strident things. Movement leaders also, and this is partly because in the end they want to persuade people on the other side.
Right.
So that means they try to get their activists to be civil and reasonable before they contact their legislator or before they contact a neighbor. And so they're often caught between these two goals, right? On the one hand, they really need to engage and excite their base. They need to fire them up. But they also don't want them to be crazy, right? They also want them to engage the representatives in a thoughtful way. They want them to talk to their neighbors and co-workers in a civil and thoughtful way. And they're sort of caught between these two demands. So that's one way in which these goods collide. Another way in which they obviously collide is that on the one hand, we want this more participatory democracy, and we want a more deliberative one. And ideally, perhaps, we'd like citizens to be open-minded in the sense that they'd change their minds readily if they were, confronted by counter-evidence. But movements don't encourage open-mindedness, right? Mm-hmm. So they encourage civility, I think, to some large degree. They encourage their activists to respectfully engage the other side. They encourage, in the case of the Christian right, they encourage activists to appeal to reason instead of scripture, but they don't encourage them to be broadly open-minded. And I think this is, in a sense, I think this is true of all movements. All movements are, in a sense, closed-minded, and they're closed-minded in the sense that, members are generally not really willing to seriously entertain other positions or really change their minds. So Martin Luther King was not really willing to seriously consider the constitutional arguments of the segregationists.
Mm-hmm.
And abolitionists were not willing to reconsider their own views on slavery. So I'm not sure there's ever really been a really open-minded social movement, right? They've all been really dogmatic. And I think if activists really doubted their cause, they wouldn't be willing to sacrifice very much for it. So here's another way, I think, in which the goods of a sort of vibrant participatory democracy on the one hand and a sort of thoughtful, deliberative one on the other are sometimes in tension. And the challenge is, what do we think of these competing goods?
Mm-hmm.
I think, if we value participation, then I think we need to be more tolerant of some of these polemics in our public life. But we can also take comfort from the fact that social movements also help educate and domesticate these moral passions.
That's a really good point, and you bring that to the fore very well in your book, that this tension does exist, and the fact that the people really starting up these movements and charging up the movements are going to be closed-minded. They're passionate about that. That's what brings them in. And I think
right.
For Christians, too, it's very difficult because scriptural arguments are usually what bring them into these movements, but then they have to make that transition to the public square by saying,
right.
If we're going to win the middle ground or we're going to win people who are not as passionate as us, we have to temper some of our rhetoric here.
That's right.
So that seems to be the major tension that we're talking about here. Your book mostly focuses on the pro-life or also the anti-abortion movement. It gives a couple nods to the gay marriage issue as well as to the general Christian right agenda. So I want to move our attention to that area. And I think most people would tend to associate the pro-life movement with Christian conservatives, particularly evangelical Christian conservatives. But one of the more fascinating things that I found that your book addresses is really the origins of this movement back in the 1960s. If you could give us a little bit of backfill on where the pro-life movement originated, that'd be great.
Yeah, sure. Well, one of the arguments I make in the book is that, the ties between the pro-life movement and 1960s liberalism is much closer than most of us have appreciated. So, for example, after the Roe decision, a campaign of civil disobedience was pioneered largely by leftist Catholics. And these were, I say they're leftists because most of them had protested the Vietnam War and nuclear proliferation. And they saw the pro-life cause as really the next front in their fight against state-sponsored violence. So the pro-life movement, if you were a Catholic leftist in the 70s in this nascent sit-in movement, you really you saw pro-life politics as entirely consistent with your dovish politics in the context of anti-war protest.
Right.
So there was a very close link there, and throughout the 1970s, it was not clear to most Americans whether the pro-life position was a conservative or a liberal one. And this is partly because neither party had really taken a hard position on the issue.
Mm-hmm.
And it was also true that many prominent Democrats spoke out against abortion, including Ted Kennedy. And Jesse Jackson spoke at a pro-life rally in D.C. in the 1970s. And he only changed his mind when he ran for president in the 1980s. So here's a case in which It'd be really hard to imagine a sort of stronger link between the civil rights movement and this nascent pro-life movement in a way than Jesse Jackson.
Right.
By the 1980s, the pro-life movement was increasingly identified in the public mind with the Republican Party and religious conservatism. And I think this is because of another number of factors. I think, one, you got a very large increase in the number of evangelical Protestants in the movement for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And these folks were generally more politically conservative than the Catholics who had helped pioneer radical pro-life politics in the 1970s. And in addition, feminists became much more influential inside the Democratic Party, and were really able to compel the party to take a firmer pro-choice stance.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, the Republican Party is taking a firmer pro-life stance. But I think the liberal links between the pro-life movement and 1960s social protest, I think it's remind all of us that this conflict isn't going to fade away anytime soon, right? I mean, both of these camps really think of themselves as heirs to the civil rights movement. That is, both pro-choice and pro-life movements have genuine links to the civil rights movement, and they both think they both imagine that they're extending the frontiers of human freedom, right? So they both think that they're advancing the civil rights movement, that they're the real heirs to that cause and that movement. And so as long as we remain the children of the Declaration of Independence, I think this conflict will continue to divide us in a way that other culture war issues will not.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I think other culture war issues, including gay marriage, are likely to fade from our collective memory, while this issue will endure, precisely because it pits us in a sort of rights conflict, right? I mean, I can't really think of another case in American history in which we've had two civil rights movements collide, right, in the way that we have in the abortion conflict.
Right. You think that's even true with the gay marriage issue? You think that the gay marriage issue will fade away over time, but abortion will not? Explain that a little bit more.
Yeah, I do. And for this reason, if you look at public opinion surveys, opinion on abortion has been really stable since the early 70s, right? I mean, it's been incredibly stable. It's one of our most stable political attitudes.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not true of most... In fact, all other social issues I can think of, most Americans have become much more liberal on social questions, including gay marriage, including gender roles. But the exception has been abortion, right? So there's been a broad liberalizing trend since the 70s, except for abortion.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it remains an exception precisely because it appeals to our rights tradition. It resonates in a sort of rights-oriented culture in a way that the conservative position on gay marriage does not. So I really think that the gay marriage controversy will likely fade. Now, of course, I could be wrong, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even though, opinion on gay marriage is liberalizing year after year, it could plateau at some point, right, unexpectedly. That could happen. But it's hard not to, notice the real contrast in trend lines.
Mm-hmm.
Between... So if you compare our Americans' view on abortion, it's very stable and stagnant. It's been that way for decades, and yet we see massive liberalization on gay rights and marriage.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting position. I hadn't thought about that before, and it's something I might think through your book. I can see how the reasoning of that would follow. Let me come back to the development of the pro-life movement.
Sure.
And I think, we talked a bit here about how the movement was in the 1970s. It comes out of the resistance to the Vietnam War type of movement. There was passive resistance to a lot of this. But in the 1980s, it starts taking a different flavor to it. It starts becoming much more confrontational, much more radical and violent. And groups like Randall Terry's Operation Rescue really come to the forefront of the movement, or at least the media attention of the movement. And what is giving fuel to that fire?
Well, the leadership of these of the movement is really changing. So in the 70s, you have a Catholic sit-in campaign. It was pioneered by John O'Keefe. And O'Keefe had a sort of a really deep ethos of nonviolence. So He thought, for example, that activists should simply go limp when the police arrive and try to cart them off to jail. And his views were really deeply shaped by a sort of Catholic mysticism that owed a real debt to Thomas Merton.
Mm-hmm.
So he thought, for example, that activists in going limp and being completely defenseless would somehow, in a sort of mystical way, share in the vulnerability of the unborn.
Mm-hmm.
But this sort of view, it wasn't universally shared even in his own crowd, and it wasn't passed on to the next generation very well. And this was true for a number of reasons. I think, first, some of the movement just thought O'Keefe's mysticism was sort of impractical, right? Because they said, well, hey, you know, the whole point is to save lives, not to have some strange mystical experience.
Mm-hmm.
Not to have some, right, a certain sort of spiritual experience. So this crowd really wanted more confrontational tactics, largely because they really wanted to do something about abortion, right? They wanted this to be efficacious. They wanted to limit abortions in some way. And they thought a key strategy just simply wasn't, wasn't effective enough.
Right.
So there was this crowd. And then there was, but there was also... in the 1980s, you had many more Protestant fundamentalists, and they tended to, of course, not to be influenced by the mysticism of Thomas Merton. They tended to be fairly radical Calvinist, and they thought that as God's chosen elect, it was really their responsibility to disobey the law, and if necessary, to do so in a militant way. And this was especially true of those who ended up bombing clinics and killing abortion providers, right?
Mm-hmm.
They thought that they were... in a sense, God's own hands, right? They were sort of God was working through them, and they were His chosen elect on earth. And human law could be disregarded and was of little consequence or importance. So you had new theological currents and influences too in the 1980s that contributed to the growing militancy of the movement. And then finally, I think there was just a sort of frustration, too. And, I mean, a lot of ways this movement was a grand failure. You know, Keith and his crowd imagined that they would, that they could blockade clinics and that they'd attract sympathy from around the nation, much in the same way that the civil rights movement did. And indeed, they looked to them as their inspiration and model. And they quickly became disillusioned. They couldn't quite attract the same media interest, and they couldn't generate the same sort of sympathy that the civil rights movement was able to. And so I think, some of those in this movement said, "Look, we need to try different things. We need to be more aggressive, and we need to be more belligerent."
One of the other things that's occurring during this time, and I found this to be a very fascinating aspect of your book, that it touches upon the abortion issue, but it also gets at the more general rise of the Christian right, is the rise of the moral majority during
right.
this period of time, and its affiliation with the anti-abortion movement, but also with other issues in general. Jerry Falwell becomes the face of
right.
the Christian right during this period of time. How does that movement rise? And the reason I'm asking this is because we'll talk a little bit about what happens in the 1990s. The moral majority rises, and by the late 1980s, 1990, it fades away.
Right.
And one would think, well, that's the end of the Christian conservative movement. But your argument is there's something else going underneath here. But I think it's important first to talk about the rise of the moral majority. So give us
sure.
a little background on that.
Well, the moral majority is one of the most misunderstood political organizations. For example, after Falwell died, there was a lot of obituaries that claimed that, he really helped fuel and pioneer the Reagan Revolution by mobilizing evangelicals and, you know, many argue that Falwell really helped create this sort of new, more powerful right.
Mm-hmm.
I actually think the overwhelming evidence suggests that that's not true. The moral majority was never really a grassroots organization. It was really a sort of checkbook organization So it was a checkbook organization in the sense that there wasn't really activists on the ground who were doing things or meeting in chapter meetings or lobbying their congressmen. It was really just a handful of folks who were writing checks to the organization. And as it happens, I think research has shown it was mostly sort of scared old ladies who gave money to Jerry Falwell. And so Falwell never really built a grassroots organization, and it was partly because his brand of fundamentalism never really appealed to the vast majority of evangelicals. So one of the most consistent survey findings in the 1980s is that evangelicals overwhelmingly dislike Falwell for many of the same reasons that unflagging atheists do. They found him too strident. They found him too militant. They agreed with him in principle on a lot of policy questions, but he didn't like the way he went about sort of pressing his case in the public square. So the moral majority never managed to build a grassroots organization, partly because it couldn't even command the respect of a majority of evangelicals, right? Much less appeal to the values voters in general. And most of its support came from, a very diffuse group of members whose donations were solicited through direct mail. It was really an organization that was built for grabbing media attention, and it did this very well, as, lots of liberal exposés demonstrate, right? These exposés chronicled the organization with hyperbolic alarm. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't really a grassroots organization, and you didn't really get that until Ralph Reed helped create the Christian Coalition in the 1990s.
Right,
and it genuinely had a sort of grassroots organization and base. It was incredibly good at increasing turnout among evangelicals. And it appealed to evangelicals precisely because it was ecumenical and relatively moderate.
Right. Whereas Falwell's organization was largely focused around Baptists.
That's right. It was independent Baptist, right, like Falwell. So it was really, the people in the organization were who were ministers who were part of the Independent Bible Fellowship.
Mm-hmm.
And these folks were distrustful of most Baptists, right? I mean, never mind, other evangelicals or Catholics. So they were not, and most of them were much more interested in building their churches. So they weren't a very good foundation for building a social movement upon, right? I mean, they were sort of unusually, sort of separatist evangelical fundamentalist who are not really interested in creating some larger movement or bridging, bringing evangelicals together in some sort of pan-Christian movement. And the Christian Coalition, just the name itself, right, suggests how different it is from the moral majority, right? Reed really wanted to build an organization that would link Christians together in common cause. And he was much more successful at appealing to evangelicals precisely because he was open to non-Baptists participating, and because he was much more civil and reasonable in the public square.
Let's come back to the Christian Coalition a minute, because
sure.
I think that tells a great deal of what is going on with the story of the pro-life movement in the 1990s, as well as the Christian evangelicals, right, and increase in political participation amongst this group in the 1990s, which is one of the most fascinating stories in your book, and somewhat counterintuitive, because as we were talking here with the moral majority and with Operation Rescue, we tend to think of the 1980s as the heyday of the Christian right movement, but
right,
it fades, and
right,
the moral majority essentially disbands by 1989, as does Operation Rescue. In fact, you do a very nice job documenting this in your book, showing how the number of violent confrontations with abortion clinics dissipates throughout the 1980s into the 1990s. So what is going on that changes, say, from 1980 to 1989 that leads to the demise of the moral majority, leads to the fading away of Operation Rescue?
Well, I think in the case of the moral majority, there was a sense in conservative Christian circles that they really needed a different kind of organization. They needed an organization that was more ecumenical and that could attract more evangelicals. And there were even critics inside the moral majority who didn't who thought it was too belligerent, too strident, that it burned too many bridges, that it wasn't good at reaching across the aisle and making compromises. So, so I think there was, even inside the moral majority, there was a real sense that maybe they needed a different public image and a different way of doing politics. Operation Rescue is a somewhat different story. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think they partly just ran out of gas. Randall Terry promised or at least held out the hope that Operation Rescue would shut down abortion clinics and really change public opinion in by dramatizing their cause, but that didn't happen. And in fact, and many activists really just ran out of steam. You know, they spent all their vacation time in jail. And they were just weary. And so I think that movement, really just sort of ran out of gas and energy, particularly because it wasn't that effective. And in addition to that, they were pretty roughed up by police, particularly mm-hmm. in Atlanta and Los Angeles. They really had some real... physical pain on top of everything else, and then Terry was just a really bad manager. He really saw Operation Rescue as his own church, in effect, and so he had this really autocratic leadership style. He was not good at delegating or building an organization. So Operation Rescue wasn't, it never really became a real sort of permanent sort of organization. It was always more of a movement than an organization. And it was probably because Terry was never really great at making that transition. He wasn't great at, creating an Operation Rescue that would endure past him. And then he wasn't a good leader on top of everything else. I mean, he had certain gifts. He was very charismatic. He was a gifted speaker. He was very energetic, but he wasn't a good manager. And so I think for all those reasons, Operation Rescue, just collapsed under its own weight.
What about the anti-racketeering statutes that the government was bringing? I don't remember that much in your book, but it would seem that the RICO statute
just
was there.
A bit. Yeah, so they were being, on top of everything, Operation Rescue was being sued. It had big legal debts. That took its toll as well.
Yeah, I would assume that if you don't have a deeply embedded organization,
right?
And Randall Terry, as you're saying, did not. That can quickly take its toll. And the other point that you make, and you just mentioned this again, was that the people in the movement just eventually burn out because they're under attack legally. They're right. Not making any headway, and as you say, in a very mundane fashion, they're losing a lot of their vacation time, and that's going to take the toll on any political movement. I think people right. oftentimes forget that.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, if you spend a month in jail, right? I mean, that's hard for most, middle class people to do, or any American to do, it was an extremely demanding form of activism. And it was hard to maintain all that in the end.
So we come up to the early 1990s now, and I think if you were watching the media coverage of this, and you do a nice job documenting the media coverage of this movement throughout time, turn on the TV in the early 1990s, you're watching the news, you would pretty much think that the pro-life movement has exhausted itself and it lost the debate,
right,
more or less. But that's really not what is going on. And the wonderful aspect of your book is that you document what is going on below the surface, below the media surface,
right,
with this movement picking up. So tell us what is happening specifically with the pro-life movement, but then you could also talk about the Christian Coalition.
Well, in the pro-life camp, there's there's a lot going on once you look past Operation Rescue, which, as you mentioned, was a sort of media lightning rod. You know, it was really terrific at drawing attention to itself. But quietly below the media radar, there was a lot going on. So, for example, there are some 2,000 crisis pregnancy centers across the country. In fact, there are more crisis pregnancy centers than there are abortion clinics. Hmm. And these centers try to, they do a number of things. They try to counsel young women who are abortion-minded and thinking about abortion. They try to discourage them from making that choice. But they also try to provide them with resources so that they can make so they can make it easier for these young women to keep their children by trying to get them access to health care and provide them with various kinds of material goods like diapers and mm-hmm. Food and cribs and these sorts of things. So crisis pregnancy centers are I think a very important institutional development. And then, despite the collapse of, the moral majority, and then the near collapse of the Christian Coalition, you still have the National Right to Life Committee, mm-hmm. which remains the most, one of the most vibrant, long-standing Christian right organizations. The National Right to Life Committee has chapters in every state. Nearly all of those states have chapters at the local level, and that group principally lobbies state legislatures and Congress when abortion legislation comes up. On top of that, there is still activity outside of abortion clinics. There's no longer blockades in the way that there used to be, but there is sidewalk counseling.
Mm-hmm.
And these are efforts by pro-life citizens to try to persuade young men and women who are seeking abortions to change their mind. And generally, the goal for these folks is to persuade them not to go through with this choice. They do so with, there's a lot of variety in this world. So some, in fact, many of them are quite civil and engage those seeking abortions in a sort of gentle, calm, and compassionate way. There are those, of course, who stand out in front of clinics and yell and scream mm-hmm. and do these sorts of things. So that's a relatively diverse world, but it's a very active one. So in most abortion clinics around the country, there's some sidewalk counseling going on in front of those clinics. There are still, of course, annual marches. And these are a very important means of drawing activists together and building solidarity within the movement. And then there's also campus outreaches, which I spend quite a bit of time talking about in my book. But there's been a lot of activity on college campuses. Groups like Justice for All and the Center for Bioethical Reform go to college campuses around the country and even in Canada, and they set up large displays of aborted fetuses on those campuses. But they're not merely there to sort of shock the students. They also try to use these images in ways that will draw students into deeper bioethical discussions about abortion and life in general.
That was actually a great part and observation of your mm-hmm. book, because when I started reading the chapter, what you entitled, I think, the varieties of the pro-life movement, you talked about the sidewalk counseling as one, you talked about the marches, and as you mentioned, you spent a lot of time on the campus mm-hmm. issue, and this is after having read the confrontational approaches of Operation Rescue and during the 1990s, and during the 1990s, you get these campus movements appearing increasingly. And what is fascinating, the tension here, and I had a student recently come into my office and we were chatting about things. He says, what really bothers me are these graphic images that these mm-hmm. groups put up on the, center of campus as you're walking by the Union Building. And, I started thinking about this. I said, well, that sounds really confrontational as well. But you're making the point in your book is that it does have that confrontational approach at the outset, but it really is meant to stir dialogue here. And this it creates an interesting counterintuitive aspect, thinking about this movement and what you talk about in terms of the democratic virtues. So how is this all working out in these campus organizations?
Sure. Well, I mean, you know, graphic images have been really controversial inside the movement. There are many pro-lifers who think they should be never be used. There are those in the middle who think they should be used, but only under certain context and circumstances. And then there are those at the other extreme who think that, you know, they should always be used as much as possible. We should just try to that pro-lifers should just try to saturate the world in these sorts of images. I guess what impresses me about the campus groups is that they tend to use them in thoughtful ways. So, yes, they set up these big dramatic images, and there is something obviously confrontational about this tactic. But they also try to soften the blow of this in a number of ways. So, for example, they post signs some distance from these graphic images warning students that these images are that they're approaching these images. But they also really draw students into more thoughtful conversations about abortion, right? So they're not there to moralize or to pass judgment on pro-choice students. They're really there to have a thoughtful conversation. And I think the other reality, and this I think is important, is that there would be no conversations taking place at all without these images. I mean, these images are sort of, they're really a sort of magnet, right? So if all these pro-lifers just went to these campuses and said, well, we'd like to start having conversations about abortion without any big dramatic images, who would stop and talk to them, right? So these images really attract a lot of students because they're curious about them. They wonder who's putting these images up. They're provocative, right? And it's a reminder that if you really want deliberation and discussion, you need to stir passions in certain ways, including passions on the other side, right? You need to give people on the other side some reason to talk to you. You need to provoke them, right? So I think these groups have found a way to really create conversations among citizens, and the only way to do that, I think, is to prick people's passions in some way, right? Otherwise, you don't get anything at all. And finally, I think, you know, the most thoughtful defenders of these images make the point that, look, all movements need these images, right? In fact, all movements who are really trying to expose what they regard as some injustice need images to make their case, right? So the civil rights movement was brilliant at this. Right, it created really dramatic images that the rest of America saw on their television screens. Opponents of the war are very good at this, right? They really think this is important. Look, you really have to see this violence in Iraq or Vietnam or Afghanistan if you really want to appreciate the gravity of the sort of policy choices we're making, right? Or opponents of child labor laws, right? This was really critical for them as well. Or advocates of animal rights, right? They really think it's critical that we really see these dead bodies to really appreciate what's going on. Even the abolitionist who did not have the advantage of modern photography, nonetheless made sketches of brutality at the hands of slaveholders. So they'd make sketches of violence against slaves that were quite controversial at the time, but they regarded as quite important.
That's true. I remember. I have to bring this up because, you know, now that you mention this, this is really resonating with me. The movie Amazing Grace, which talks about the abolitionist movement in England and William Wilberforce, one of the very powerful scenes was when Wilberforce actually takes a group of well-to-do English people who are isolated from this to one of the slave ships and just takes them and walks them through there. And that's the equivalent of the images that we see today on campus, either in the abortion movement or, you know, in the Vietnam War protests and such.
Right. Yeah, so if you're a member of any of these movements, right, you have a sense that we've all averted our eyes from some evil, right? None of us look inside slaughterhouses or inside abortion clinics or at the battlefields in Vietnam. And, you know, I think they reasonably say, hey, look, you know, if we're going to defend any practice, we have to be willing to face up to it in some real way. And I think that's a reasonable claim for any movement to make. I think it's a reasonable claim for animal rights activists to make, for anti-war activists to make, and for pro-life activists to make. And it's even reasonable to make on deliberative terms, right? Because in some ways they want to reveal, it's a sort of evidence, right? I mean, they want to, right, reveal some truth, which we try to shut our eyes from. But if we're going to be honest about these things, you know, I think we have to, well, I think we have to look at them in some sense. We have to acknowledge what's going on in some, you know, I don't think we have to dwell on them in some deep way. We have to sort of, you know, be macabre about it. But I do think we need to be willing to sort of look at what we're defending.
And this brings up what we were talking at the very outset of our podcast here, when we were talking about how parts of the movements really need to stir passions, but on the other hand, need to transition to that reasonable discussion. And and you make the case that these campus groups do this very well. And in the first chapter of your book, you actually detail remarkably well how a number of these pro-life movements have been training their workers, training their activists to become more civil in that discourse. Tell us about what these groups are doing to enhance the democratic virtues, as you call it.
Well, it depends a little bit on the group and the context. In the case of campus groups, they want to do two things. I mean, really, they want to get them to, they want their activists to be able to get into a real conversation with people. And that usually means at the outset that they want their activists to really ask questions of whoever they're talking to, right? They want to get a sense of what their positions are, why they hold them. So they don't want someone who's going to approach some other student and make lots of declarations or make lots of moral statements or articulate some elaborate philosophy, but they want them to sort of draw the other person in by getting them to articulate and defend their own position. And then they want them gently to challenge it in some way, right? They want them to challenge it or question the other person's point of view. And they can do this in all kinds of ways. One of the popular ways of doing this in the group that I looked at is when I explore this campus group, one of the images they have is an image of the development of an embryo through various stages of development until the embryo becomes a newborn. And one of the things, you know, these activists will do is ask students to point to, you know, at what stage in the development of this organism does it become a rights-bearing person, right? Is it when it has brain activity, when it has a heartbeat, when it's viable, you know, sort of what stage in this development do they become a sort of rights-bearing person? And then they ask them to really just defend that point of view. You know, what is it about that difference that really is morally significant? I think that's, in my sense, is that was a particularly effective and impressive way of really creating, serious bioethical conversations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the training there that goes on is really, you know, what you were talking about before, moving the discussion to the arena of reason rather than relying upon a impassioned appeal to scripture or some philosophical debate.
Right, right. But again, you know, it depends on the context, right? So if you're a sidewalk counselor, right, you don't want to get in a deep philosophical conversation about the ontology of the embryo, generally speaking, right? That's not your principal goal. If you're a sidewalk counselor, usually you want to figure out why that person wants an abortion. Mm-hmm. And if there's some other way that person's needs can be met, right? So if there's some material concerns, if they're for example, or there's some health, or there's some lack of health care, or some lack of support, sidewalk counselors want to know what those concerns are so that they can, so that they can offer some sort of help to that person.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very different context from, say, a campus where, for the most part, people aren't, right, considering, an abortion at that moment. And there you can have much more reflective philosophical conversations about, you know, the ontology of a human person, and so I think the sort of activism, really shapes the sorts of conversations that you get in this movement.
And these conservative Christian groups seem to be getting increasingly better at doing this. I mean, we talked about the Christian Coalition before, and I want to come back to that now. One of the things that is surprising about your book is in one of the latter chapters, you move away from the discussion of abortion per se and just talk about participation. So at the beginning of the podcast, we talked about deliberative norms of just dialoguing with one another. But then there's that issue of civic engagement, of participation. And in terms of Christian conservatives, you highlight what seems to be a fairly prevalent myth amongst social scientists and the public at large that the conservative Christians were highly motivated and active in the 90s and have seemed to fade away until then. But you show with a lot of empirical evidence that this really isn't the case. What is going on with Christian conservatives in terms of their political participation, say, dating back to the early 1970s?
Well, I mean, throughout the 20th century, conservative, you know, white conservative evangelical voters turned out at far lower rates than other citizens. And I think this alienation is really rooted in a number of movements at the turn of the century when you got, there was a number of currents that really challenged Protestant orthodoxy. So you had the rise of Darwinism and social Darwinism. You had the rise of liberal Protestant theology. And, you know, I think all of these currents really challenged the cultural power of conservative evangelicals. Mm-hmm. And very quickly, conservative evangelicals felt like a stranger in their own country. So in the 19th century, they are sort of the center of American politics and culture. By the 1920s, they're a sort of laughing stock. They're, as George Marsden once put it, they're ideological strangers in their own land. And this was very traumatic for a lot of evangelicals. And many reacted by retreating from politics and the culture to some large degree. They built their own subculture with their own you know, schools with their own Christian Science establishment, and then there were certain theological changes too, which encouraged this retreat, including the rise of premillennialism, which encouraged evangelicals to
Really worry about the hereafter, and not now.
Just worry about saving their souls and not worry about transforming society, because indeed the world is just going to get worse and worse.
Mm-hmm.
So in many ways they were among the most alienated sort of group of Americans in the last century. And in '60s and '70s it would have been really hard to predict that they once again move back to the center of American politics and cultural life, and this was a startling development. It was certainly not anticipated by the new left. The new left really cared about participatory democracy, but they didn't imagine that there'd be this revival, in a way, this participatory revival, as I call it, among conservative evangelicals.
And what's interesting is that it doesn't happen in the 1980s you think it would, when a lot of the media attention, again, is on the moral majority, but it really occurs in the 90s.
Right. Now, that's right. So in terms of voter turnout, you don't see a revival until the 1990s, and it's largely because of the Christian Coalition, which was especially good at mobilizing new voters, at bringing evangelicals back into the political fold.
You mentioned putting them in deep into the grassroots, that one of the Christian Coalition's goals was to have 10 activist members in every precinct across the country, which is that's quite a goal to have.
Yeah, right. So Ralph Reed really wanted to build this sort of political machine, right? This institution that had deep roots in local American communities and neighborhoods, and he was quite successful. He didn't reach his goal perfectly. I mean, he didn't he didn't have activists on the ground in every precinct. But the organization did manage to dramatically increase turnout. Mm-hmm. And I think the interesting thing is that turnout has largely sustained itself, even though the Christian Coalition has largely collapsed. So mm-hmm. today, the Christian Coalition is really a sort of shell of its former self. But nonetheless, this participation has maintained itself. So evangelicals in this last decade have participated at high rates, particularly in 2004. I think the question, you know, is whether or not this increase in participation will be maintained in mm-hmm. the future. You know, will evangelicals feel inclined to retreat back into their private lives and own subculture once again?
And what are your thoughts on that? I mean, this is our opportunity yeah. now as we near the end of our podcast to do some, you know, wild and crazy speculation mm-hmm. that we're told not to do in graduate school, but
that's
as
right.
social
that's
scientists,
right.
we just can't help but do that.
Yeah, well, you know, I think at this stage, I think it's safer to say that maybe this participation will be sustained into the future.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure I would have said this 10 years ago. But I think there's some reason to believe that they'll continue turning out, largely because they keep turning out even though the organization that initially mobilized them is really collapsed to some large degree. So that suggests to me that this increase in participation will continue into the future.
When you plant the seeds of the yeah. grassroots, once the sower is gone, the grass still grows.
Yeah, and there's apparently some good empirical evidence this is true. Apparently, voting behavior is partly just a habit.
Right.
So once you're in the habit of voting, you continue to do that into the future.
And it passes on to generations. Your children see you doing it, so they do it as well.
That's right. So I don't know that, you know, there'll really be a retreat from politics again in the way that we saw in the 1920s and 1930s. Right. There would have to be some new sort of dramatic shock, I would imagine, some cultural or political shock for that to happen, and that doesn't seem likely.
Let me ask you, and again, we're recording this on November 2nd in the middle of a hotly contested midterm election here. What are your thoughts on Christian conservatives in the Tea Party movement? For me, it's an interesting thing, and you know, I'm going to absolve you any responsibility for your speculation here, because we, as social scientists, we really like to wait until the data come in. But you know, part of me sees this movement as a very secular movement concerned about baseline economic issues, taxation, healthcare policy, unemployment, government regulation, and such. But on the other hand, you know, I think back to this Glenn Beck rally to
right.
restore honor, and I think I was somewhat surprised by that. When I first heard that it was going to be happening, I said, oh, it's going to be another Tea Party issue that really revolves around economic issues. But it really was
right.
quite the opposite. It was very much a religious type of rally,
right.
maybe a new great awakening. I don't know if I would go
right.
that far to say that, even though I just said that. But
right.
what's your thoughts on this?
I honestly don't know what to make of the Tea Party movement. You know, and I think partly the problem is, and this used to be the problem with the Christian right, is that almost everything we know about the Tea Party movement is journalistic.
Mm-hmm.
And this was true of the Christian right for a long time. And for that reason, it was really, you know, misunderstood. So I think I guess I don't entirely trust the media accounts, partly because, not necessarily because they're biased, but just because they're superficial.
Right.
I'm not really sure. I guess the one thing I would say about the Glenn Beck rally is that I was struck by its civility.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, this impressed everyone. I think on the left and the right, but maybe we shouldn't be that surprised by it. You know, that this is, you know, insofar as this is a movement that's been shaped by an emphasis on the sort of deliberative norms that I've described, I mean, it's not shocking to me that you'd, you know, your average activist would actually be quite respectful and civil in the public square.
Which is interesting because, again, many people consider Glenn Beck himself to be rather strident and in your face about a lot of things. But, you know, yet the crowd that he appeals to and the crowd that draws in has, you know, possibly had this training in these civic norms, these civil norms over the past decade or so that you really see it manifesting itself nowadays in larger rallies.
Yeah, it's that, and I think the average Christian activist is just not attracted to this sort of strident militancy in the public square. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just, there was always some who were attracted to this kind of politics. I mean, you saw these folks in Operation Rescue, for example. But for the most part, this sort of politics just doesn't appeal to most evangelicals. I mean, they simply think it's sort of unchristian, right, to scream and shout in the public square. And I think it's one of the reasons the Christian Coalition was so much better at appealing to evangelicals than the moral majority. And if the Tea Party, or at least most of those who consider themselves sympathetic to the Tea Party, are to be mobilized into some interest group, I think that leadership will, have to accommodate some of these sensibilities. Mm-hmm. That most of these activists, don't want to conduct themselves in the public square this way.
And I think you're absolutely right too in terms of that tenor to the movement and how it's changed over the years. And your book is an excellent read in terms of doing this. So I think anybody within the Tea Party movement should actually pick up a copy of your book, as well as anybody who's interested in this material. And I think, you know, again, looking back, you know, perhaps 10 years into the future, we look back at the Tea Party movement, we'll be able to find some interesting things that probably resonate with the research that you're doing right now. And that gives you a future research agenda as well, which
you can't complain
about.
Yeah, well, if I was in graduate school I'd write a book on the Tea Party movement.
Yeah. So, well, John, it's been great having you on the show today, and we appreciate all your insights on that. And thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.